It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if you want to build a healthy lifestyle, it helps to build it into your daily routine. We'll hear the stories of several people who made running part of their daily habits for months, even years, in many cases without missing a day. First, in one way or another, the pandemic has changed daily life for just about everyone. And even for those who weren't affected directly by the health impacts of coronavirus or had their jobs shut down by the outbreak, a lot of people are taking another look at their priorities in life. Our next guest says it's a good time to reflect on the values of slowing down and a simpler way of living. Christopher Kimball is founder of Christopher Kimball's Milk Street, which includes a national TV show and radio show, a magazine, and a cooking school. Milk Street Radio airs here on the Ideas Network on Sundays at 10 a.m. His new editorial is called The Simple Life. It'll be published in the July-August issue of Milk Street Magazine next month. Christopher Kimball, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, in this piece, you look back at your own childhood. Can you tell us some of your story growing up in farm country?
Yeah, I was very, very fortunate. My mother was really the one who wanted to build the cabin in Vermont. We didn't live there full time, but summers and weekends. And I worked on a local dairy farm as a kid. I spent a lot of time with farmers who had no indoor plumbing. You know, there was a place called the Yellow Farmhouse. It was right on the town line. And people would stop by because Briggs lived there. She was a town baker. So you get a slice of bread with a thick smear of butter on it or a molasses cookie. And she cooked in a wood, you know, Kalamazoo cook stove. And they had a cow out back and a few workhorses. And, you know, life hadn't changed in really 200 years in that spot. And that's where I spent a lot of my childhood. So time moved very slowly. I remember being in that front parlor. And those old houses, you know, everyone just sat in the parlor. That's where the stove was and the dining room table. And, you know, 5-10 minutes would go by, nobody would talk because nobody had something to say, you know, which is so different than social media today. So it was a lot of time with 5 or 6 people sitting around in the middle of winter and nobody talking, you know, and then someone would tell a story and then they would stop. And so it was an antidote to modern society. And I was just very fortunate to have spent a number of years there.
And now here we are in, you know, various kinds of quarantines and shutdowns and worried about the pandemic. You looked back on that time and thought about maybe this as an opportunity to reflect on the value of slowing down by choice, by necessity in some cases. How can we try to capture some of that spirit in a difficult time?
Well, I kind of think the bigger question for us all is, are we at a watershed moment in the culture? You know, these things you can never predict, and you have to look back 20 years later. But I think we are. I think we're at a point where we sort of run out, you know, a lot of the themes that we've been dealing with for decades. You know, and I remember there was a guy back in the 70s, sort of a guru, and he used to ask people, you know, how much is enough, right? And the question is, we have too much. And I don't mean too much money necessarily. I just too many things in our life. And so I look back and you think about, you know, what are the things that matter? And I'm a little older. You know, time for me is really the most valuable thing. So how you spend your time, to use a monetary verb, becomes important. And I think in the last couple months, regardless of whether your financial situation, which is pretty grim for a lot of people in the restaurant business, you do have to think about how you spend your time. I think a lot of people are now thinking, well, maybe I haven't been spending my time well, and that would be a watershed moment. You know, maybe people are not going to commute every day to work. Maybe people don't need as much stuff, you know, including me. And maybe we need to rethink the basic premises of living. I mean, I don't look back. You know, life 100 years ago when I was 50s was easy. You know, we can't look back and go, well, what a, you know, perfect lifestyle it was. It was hard for a lot of people. But on the other hand, there's something we've lost along the way. And I think people want to recapture that, or for many people experiencing that firsthand for the first time.
And you make a point in the piece we're talking about. You don't want to romanticize suffering. There's a point beyond which this isn't a character-building lesson.
No.
It is genuinely a problem. You don't want to overlook that.
Yeah, I mean, look, I know a lot of people. I'm not in the restaurant business. I never wanted to be, but I know a lot of my good friends are, and this is pretty serious. I mean, a lot of these restaurants are not going to reopen. And, you know, and restaurants live on a very 3-4% margin. You know, they don't have a lot of cash. And then the other problem is going to be if they're operating at 50 or 60% of capacity with, you know, social distancing with tables, you can't make a living. You know, you need people at a crowded bar to make a living in the restaurant business. So I don't, you know, I don't quite understand how that's going to work out, although I know a lot of people in the business who will make it work. And so I don't want to, you know, talk about people suffering and go, well, this is a spiritual moment for us all. You know, it's not spiritual when you can't pay your rent, you know, and you can't afford food. That being said, however, I think this is an interesting time. You know, there was a book recently published by Russ Duhout of the New York Times called Our Decadent Society. He makes a really interesting point. He said, you know, we're really not in an innovative time. If you go back to the Victorian era versus 1960, everything was new, you know, cars, airplanes, telephones, refrigerators, et cetera, the radio. He said, yeah, we have personal computers now, but my home back in the 50s and 60s really wasn't different than my home today, right? I mean, most of the things have been invented. And so the question is, are we sort of at the end of an era, which I mentioned earlier? And I think we are. So it's not just simpler. It's how do you make decisions about how to live? You know, and I think we've all been going so fast at a breakneck speed. I include myself. I travel around the world all the time to do work for Milk Street and et cetera. You know, that's great. It's I love it. But there are other things I'm missing, too. And so now maybe this is a good time. I sort of said this is sort of a time for spring cleaning. Right. It's a time to we got to throw out some things here. And the question is, what are we going to throw out?
Talking to Christopher Kimball, founder of Christopher Kimball's Milk Street. You can hear Milk Street Radio here on the Ideas Network Sundays at 10 a.m. He's talking about thinking about the way we live our lives, the value of slowing down and maybe settling into new patterns. And Christopher, this was a shocker to me. You said one of your favorite ways to slow down and appreciate your time is to do work in the kitchen. Okay, it's not really a shocker, but can you talk about how you value that time?
Yeah, I mean, I've said this for decades now. If you think about the kitchen, it's so simple. It's a room, and you have a clear purpose, you know, to prepare food. It has food, it has knives, it has heat, and it has everything, I think, everything you really want to cherish about being human. Work, which I grew up, you know, New England, work is everything, you know, being useful. Community, obviously, friends and family. Frugality, you know, the best cooks are the ones that know how to take leftovers or simple ingredients and make a meal out of it. Sustenance, I mean, all those things. And I think also, and I didn't say this in the piece, I think the way time passes in the kitchen is very different than the way it passes in other places in your life. You slow down, you have a task in front of you, you forget the rest of the world. And so I view the kitchen as a very special place in terms of, if you want, your soul, but also in terms of how you relate to time passing. And I think the big discussion now is how do we want time to pass? How are we going to spend our time? You can't spend it any better than cooking for your family and friends. I mean, it just doesn't get any better than that. It's enormously satisfying. It's useful, which I think is really important. I think, you know, in Vermont, even if you're 90 years old, you know, you have a role in the community, and that's true for any farm community. And it's a way of slowing down in a way that's not just sitting, you know, watching television, but you're actually doing something for the people, which I think everybody agrees is something we're all rethinking right now.
Christopher, maybe you can help me get in that mindset better. Sometimes I'm there when I'm cooking, and sometimes I feel like the time I'm spending is really expensive and I have to get things done quickly. And sometimes that's true, but how can I be more toward that? This is time well spent. I can cherish and enjoy this moment as opposed to the time pressure of cooking.
Well, that's an interesting point. You know, when I first started in the food world in the 70s, food and cooking was being sold by big food companies as an inconvenience. Going back to the 1880s and 90s, that's when the food companies really started up. They sold their product to save time. And when women mostly were spending 7 hours a day preparing food, which was true in the 1880s, that made a lot of sense because that's a lot of time. I think what's happened is that has run its course to some extent, and now we're spending much less time cooking. So I would say to you, you know, if you think of all the other things you spend time on during the day, this is a relatively small amount of time, and it's probably the most valuable. So I would look at cooking as the reward for all the other time you spend in the day, the work you did and everything else. You finally get to get in the kitchen, and you just have to enjoy it. I've spoken to so many cooks who say when they walk in the kitchen, they just get happy. You know, everything else stops, and they enter a new sort of state of being. And so it's a joy. So if you look at cooking as an inconvenience, something you have to do to feed yourself, you're not going to enjoy it. But for most people around the world, even if they do a lot of it, there's a great joy in the kitchen, you know, the joy of cooking. And I think you have to embrace that. I would say, you know, just start with 10 recipes, right? I mean, or 5 recipes that you learn to make without using a recipe. You don't have to master Mexican cooking and 35 different cuisines in India and Sichuan, the 52 different cooking methods in Sichuan food cooking. You know, have 5 or 10 recipes and get good at them. It doesn't matter what they are. It could be mac and cheese or, you know, a simple piece of chicken. But get good at those. And then when you get in the kitchen, you don't have to worry about whether it's going to come out. You don't have to worry about finding the recipe. You can make it. And that'll give you the confidence. It's like playing guitar. You know, learn 3 songs, right, so you can play the song. Then you're good to go. And if you want to do other stuff, fine. But you've got a few basics, you know, under your belt, and you'll be confident. The problem with cooking with people is it's fear of failure. I think that's one thing you sort of intimated. And I know people who give cooking classes who say that's really true. So master 5 recipes. Just start with 5. And then all of a sudden you're not afraid of failure in the kitchen.
We're talking to Christopher Kimball of Milk Street about his new editorial about living a simpler life in the kitchen and beyond, and maybe rethinking the way we spend our time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How has the pandemic changed the way you live? Have you had to become more resourceful in the kitchen, making do with less? Have you rethought the way you spend your time? Are you looking for ways to slow down and appreciate things, your life a little more, and maybe rely less on things for enjoyment? And have you turned to cooking for some peace? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can join the conversation. We'll pick it up coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Christopher Kimball from Milk Street. We're looking at his latest piece in the magazine about living a simpler life in the kitchen and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. I know during the pandemic, a lot of people have gotten into different forms of cooking and baking for comfort, to do nice things for the people maybe they're enclosed with in their house while they can't go out and do as much. Is that you? Have you gotten into or back into some kind of cooking or baking? Is there something you've had to make do without? How have you found some substitutions? Do you find peace in the kitchen? And have you found ways to enjoy maybe a slower pace of life, if that's your life right now? It isn't for everyone, of course. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Christopher, that idea of making do, again, it's kind of an old-time thing that I think a lot of people are getting back into now. Can you talk about that spirit of, hey, we don't have the exact ingredients for this recipe, we could still pull it off?
Well, I remember, you know, we grew up, we weren't poor, but I remember people used paper bags from the grocery store to make Halloween masks. I think one year I did have a lion mask made with a paper bag, or they use it for book covers, right? I mean, you know, for a brown paper book cover. You know, the coffee cans held nuts and bolts in the garage. And if you think about the best cooking in the world, I think it's based upon being frugal, right? It's about the simple things. One of the things, you know, at Mill Street, we really believe in is spices. And so you can do an amazing amount with spices if you want to change the flavor of something or you're making a substitution. The things that I do have been doing the last couple months is I cook a lot of beans on a Sunday. I could use an Instant Pot or pressure cooker or just cook them on the stove and repurpose those beans all sorts of different ways during the week. I cook a big roast. Again, I could use a pressure cooker or I could cook it in water and I can repurpose that pizza throughout the week. So being able to take a basic ingredient, you know, I roast a couple of chickens on a Sunday, I can reuse those throughout the week. And I think that's really the best part of cooking is when you understand a simple formula. You know, years ago, I was talking to Julia Child about custards for some reason. And she said, oh, yeah, that's a cup of dairy and two eggs. And I went like, oh, yeah. I was like, I went back and looked at my old recipes, you know, like a pumpkin pie or something. That's a custard. Yeah, it was a cup of dairy and two eggs. So once you see underneath a recipe, like a basic stir fry, right, you stir fry the protein, you take it out. You know, you do the vegetables, you put the garlic and ginger in, you put the meat back in a sauce or a basic curry, or very generic term in India. But you start with whole spices, you cook them in oil, you have the onions, later on you have the ground spices. There's sort of a five-part system there. Once you get that, then you can make substitutions, because then you realize that, you know, what bean can be substituted for something else, or one kind of rice for another, or this kind of meat for another, because the underlying concept is still the same.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Mary is with us in La Crosse. Mary, hello.
Hello. I just tuned in about 15 minutes ago, but I've had an idea running through my head for years because I'm almost 82. So I grew up when there was home economics, sewing one semester, cooking one semester. And you learned the you started out with the very, very basics. And it was required for 2 years. And then I remember when I was in high school, and the home ec girls, at that time it was just girls, were baking bread and the smell of bread wafting through. And when my own children were in junior high and high school, boys were allowed, but it wasn't the same old home economics that I was raised in. And I see in my grandchildren them struggling. They want to do the cooking, but they're missing out on some of the very, very basic things that would have made everything so much easier now.
Thank you so much for the call, Chris, for the idea of getting kids into it, whether it's in a home ec class in school or, you know, with a parent.
This is my dream, is to have home ec come back to public schools. I think it's absolutely, you know, I took shop and then my sister took home ec. Absolutely. What a great idea. I mean, we've gotten rid of all these things in public schools that are so essential. I mean, in Mill Street, we do outreach to Boys and Girls Clubs and some Girl Scouts and other things. And we do teach. We bring kids in and teach them to cook. It's part of what we do. And now we're doing it, you know, using Zoom and doing it online. But what a great idea. I mean, teaching kids those basics. And I don't know. I just don't understand why we've decided that's not part of the education. It certainly is.
Mary, thanks a lot for that call. Christopher's on board, it sounds like. We'll go now to John in Toma. John, hi.
Hi. I'd like to give my thanks to Christopher on the PBS channel, Cook's Country, S Kitchen. I've watched that for years, and I've got a lot of good tips, and I've become a really good cook because of it. In all the bean shows on the PBS TV channel in general, and I really appreciate it, and I really can say I've become a lot better cook because of it, and yeah, thanks.
John, thank you so much. That's got to be nice to hear, Christopher.
You know, the nicest thing is when someone comes up and says exactly that, you know, because being a good cook is, you know, just a wonderful thing.
Thank you so much, John, for calling in and sharing that. I noticed, I was looking at your blog on Milk Street that you and your colleagues put together. And, you know, sometimes with cooking blogs, people are featuring these really exotic ingredients. Lately, I'm seeing things like canned tuna and frozen peas and the scallions or green onions. Like, we can do a lot of cool stuff with ingredients that we might think of as, you know, pretty humble stuff to begin with.
Well, we just did two little at-home videos. We're doing these at-home videos now on Instagram and Facebook. The two I love the best are how to make tomato sauce, which is tomato paste, which was really great. It was brilliant. I didn't do it. My director of education did it. And she also did one on how to cook frozen broccoli. You take the frozen broccoli and put it right into a skillet frozen. And the water from the broccoli ends up being part of the sauce. And it's just, it's a 10-minute recipe. You end up charring the broccoli and making a sauce. So, you know, frozen broccoli into a cast iron skillet and then tomato sauce just with tomato paste, no tomatoes is, yeah, I mean, it's great. I mean, those are the kind of tips that are just absolutely fabulous. I just love it.
In our last minute or so, Christopher, again, there's a lot of bad stuff going on now, but how do you think we can capture the spirit of slowing down in a way that, you know, we're going to remember it a year or 5 years from now and integrate it into our lives in a positive way?
Well, on one hand, I'd say the epidemic of 1918, then there was a roaring 20s, right? So, I think on one hand, people are going to flock back to bars and restaurants and beaches and other things. That's going to happen. But here's what I think. I think these few months that we spent at home will have a lasting impact because it was enough time for us to be shocked out of our, you know, traditional roles and experiencing our families and being at home and at times slowing down. I don't think we're going to forget that. And it's, you know, my parents grew up in the Great Depression, and I can tell you that the way they thought about, you know, they had money, but the idea of spending all this money on entertainment just never occurred to them. Right? I mean, it wasn't even a good idea. They wouldn't, you know, it just never happened. So I think people are going to remember this. Maybe it's only a few months, but it's such a shock to our system that we just stopped. The music stopped. And we got off for a little while. I don't think we're going to get back on in the same way. I think it'll be changed for a very long time. And I hope for the better.
Christopher, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, my great pleasure. Thank you.
That's Christopher Kimball of Milk Street. We talked to him about his upcoming piece in Milk Street magazine, The Simple Life. Coming up after the news, we'll hear about people who have made running part of their daily routines and what it means for them physically and emotionally. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin's Supreme Court struck down the state's Safer at Home order yesterday. We'll talk to the Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin about his reaction and what the executive branch and the legislature could do next. First, what if you went for a run every day for the next year? Not your cup of tea. How about the next 40 years? The current active record for what's called run streaking, or running every day for consecutive days, is 18,616 days, or almost 51 years, held by a man named John Sutherland. For women, the total is 14,636 days, or just over 40 years, held by Lois Bastian. You don't have to be superhuman to do this. In fact, you don't even have to be a runner. You can choose your amount of time and how much you want to run. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've ever gotten one of these running streaks on your own self, we'd love to hear from you, no matter how short or long you kept it up. What motivated you to try? Did it bring any benefits to your life? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Elizabeth Millard is a freelance writer focusing on health, wellness, fitness, and food. She wrote a feature, Streaking Helped Me, for Runner's World magazine. Elizabeth, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Well, you profile a bunch of people who built these running streaks for a variety of reasons. First of all, can you talk to us about the idea behind this and why it's different from what a lot of runners might normally do?
Yeah, absolutely. So Runner's World has maintained that kind of streak of their own, I would say. They started in 2011 doing a Thanksgiving to New Year's streak for readers. And it was just a way to kind of invite people into the running community. And since then, they've maintained the Thanksgiving to New Year's, but they've also added, like they're doing this year, which is Memorial Day to the 4th of July. And just a little bit of a challenge for people, something fun, something new. And I think that this year, it's especially compelling just because so many races have gotten canceled.
Is this something you've done yourself?
I have done some consecutive days of running, yes, but not certainly 47 years or whatever it is.
Well, right. No, I didn't mean that length of running. You've strung some days together, though, from time to time, it sounds like.
Yeah, I have strung some days together. But, you know, in talking to a lot of the people that I profiled, they're so inspiring, and I think that I didn't give it enough time to be kind of truly transformative in the way that they found it to be. So I think I'm going to give it another shot.
Now let's talk about the transformative nature of this. And some of the people you profile in the piece got through some very difficult times in their lives, in part through building this daily running habit. Can you share a story or two?
Sure. You know, they were so fascinating in terms of where they started. Most of them started as a way to kind of overcome something. So there were a couple that were dealing with a very, you know, difficult divorce. One of them was fighting breast cancer, and she was in active treatment at the time that she was running, which is just phenomenal. And she talked about how she would have to sit down and cry sometimes when she was running, but she felt like doing that run was part of her mental health and feeling like she'd be more resilient to get through treatment. And I interviewed a woman who, and it wasn't the only woman that I've talked to, who was 8 months pregnant.
Wow.
At the time that she was doing her run streak, and she since has sent me an email and said that she did indeed stick to her plan to run on her delivery day. So she got her mile in.
Wow.
on her day, and she's not the only one I've talked to that has run on a delivery day. So kudos, you know.
Now, a lot of people are probably in my boat and think this sounds overwhelming, but it sounds like you kind of set your own pace and your own distances and things like that. And you know, you don't have to feel like, yeah, I'm doing a marathon, you know, every day. And not that anybody's doing that so much, but we can kind of set our own milestones if we do a running streak.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that if you want to do something that's within the definition of the U.S. Running Streak Association, so you want to be completely legit, then the definition is a mile per day. But that is not a continuous mile. It used to be, but they changed the definition. So if you want to do a quarter mile four times in one day, then you can do that. But, you know, apart from the definition, let's say that you just want to do a quarter mile anyway and you just decide to do it every day. I think that the more important thing is to do it every day as opposed to the actual mileage that you're putting in.
Talking to Elizabeth Millard, a writer who focuses on health, wellness, fitness, and food, about a piece she wrote for Runner's World magazine. She profiled a bunch of different people who had done these running streaks where they set consecutive goals. Every day they ran X amount. They shared their stories in this piece. Another one I thought I was really amazed by, a person named Mo, I think, who hadn't ran in a long time. She used it to help stay sober. Can you talk about that story a little bit?
Yeah, and Mo was another one who she started the run streak as a way to kind of overcome a difficult breakup. And she was challenged during that kind of traumatic time in her life to kind of revert back to some behaviors that she had, so to go back to not being sober. And so when she started running, she thought, you know, she felt good every time she ran. She felt like she was running further away from, you know, that risk of addiction. That's another profile that I did, James Henson. He was also running to stay sober as part of his recovery. So, I mean, it's kind of a beautiful story that they can see the benefit of running as a way to kind of build their emotional health.
I wanted to mention James Henson's story because he's a trucker, and I've heard over the years on this show and other shows a lot from truckers who, I understandably, have a hard time getting exercise into their daily lives. How did he on the road make this daily running habit work?
He is so amazing. So he would stop at a rest stop, and he told me that, you know, running at a rest stop is not a great idea just because of all the diesel fumes. So he would use an app to find running routes in whatever place he was in. And off he would go. He would get changed in his truck, into his running clothes. And at first it was just a little bit to explore. And, you know, it's such a sedentary kind of profession. So it helped him to kind of clear his head a little bit more when he was on the road. And he told me a great story about how he was almost to the end of one run, and he was in Ohio, and he turned around and there was a whole buggy full of Amish people behind him, like cheering him on. So he decided to go a little bit further. It's really sweet, the kinds of places that people go to and the experiences they have, because every run is different.
Now, the mindset and the mentality here is interesting to me, because a lot of times when I think of runners, they're getting ready for whatever. If they're starting off, it might be the 5K, or they're getting ready for the marathon, or the ultra marathon, or whatever it might be. This isn't necessarily that. This is kind of a different approach, isn't it?
Yeah, and definitely. Some of them are training for something, but I think the mindset is to have that consistency and that structure. And, you know, one thing that really struck me is that there's a very common thread besides running with everyone, which is that the benefits, the kind of emotional, mental benefits, crept up on them a little bit. So they just found more focus, they felt more disciplined. You know, the woman I mentioned who was pregnant said that she felt like she was a better parent, calmer, all that great stuff.
That's interesting. It crept up on them. They were probably went in thinking, and some of the stories, I'm going to get physical benefits of this. I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to be in better shape, things like that. The people you talked to in some cases didn't foresee those benefits you were just talking about, the mental and emotional.
Yeah, there's a ripple effect where they all of a sudden, maybe there's a situation they would have been angry at before, and then now they're, you know, calmer in there. And then they attribute that to their run streak.
As we wrap up, Elizabeth, you mentioned Runner's World is doing that challenge starting Memorial Day, and that sounds nicer for runners here in Wisconsin than the one that runs Thanksgiving to New Year's.
And maybe you have to be a little tougher to do the other one.
Yeah, exactly. Are you going to be on board starting Memorial Day?
I think I will be. I read back over the article, and I think I'm in.
Well, good luck to you keeping that up, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks so much.
That's Elizabeth Millard, freelance writer focusing on health, wellness, fitness, and food. She wrote the feature, Streaking Helped Me, for Runner's World magazine. We've got a few links where you can learn more about run streaking up at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, Wisconsin's lieutenant governor joins us to talk about yesterday's court ruling, striking down the state's safer at home order, and what comes next. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, COVID-19 statistics keep rolling in from day to day, and our guest is worried that we're getting desensitized to the numbers. First, the Wisconsin Supreme Court struck down the state's safer at home order yesterday, saying that the Department of Health Services didn't have the authority to issue the order without going through the legislature. The order was scheduled to last until May 26th. Governor Evers spoke today with Republican leaders in the legislature, whose approval he would now need for any further orders, statewide orders, dealing with the COVID-19 outbreak. In the meantime, several counties and municipalities have put their own rules in place. Elsewhere, businesses are free to open. Last night, many bars around the state opened up and were filled with patrons. Wisconsin Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes joins us now to talk about the ruling and what could come next. Lieutenant Governor Barnes, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Well, can you give us your initial reaction to this ruling from the state Supreme Court yesterday?
Yeah, the initial reaction was frustration, as was the reaction of so many other people across the state, especially those who've done everything, who've made significant sacrifices to do everything that we could do to stop the spread of COVID-19 in Wisconsin. And when I say everybody, I don't mean just from a standpoint of the administration. I mean so many frontline workers, so many medical professionals, people all across the state who stepped up to meet the challenge. And we actually met the challenge relatively well. If you look at our neighbors, the states that border us, we performed somewhat better. And I hate to say you performed better, you know, when we're talking about sickness and death. But if you look at the rate of infection and the total number of deaths, Wisconsin, we show leadership. And it was because of our safer at home order, we were able to keep people protected. And the state Supreme Court dealt an unnecessary blow to that progress.
Well, looking at the timeline here, the safer at home order was scheduled to expire on the 26th. So 12 days early, and now counties and local governments, especially in the hardest hit areas, are putting in their own local orders. Others could follow suit if things spread there. Is it really that drastic a change given all that's going on?
Yeah, because it creates confusion. I think that's the worst part about it. And the reason why the United States, the reason why we lead the globe, the amount of infections and death, is because there wasn't a streamlined process. There wasn't a streamlined set of guidelines to get people through this, and states were left to figure it out. Some states with more relaxed rules saw higher rates of transmission. I can use Iowa as an example. They have about half of our population, and three times as many people lost their lives to COVID-19. And also, I should say that given the way that that structure was set up when it came to response to COVID-19, we're going to see ourselves in a similar position where counties and municipalities are going to have to figure it out. And if places are doing it differently than each other, we could see an influx of people traveling to certain parts of the state, certain counties. And you have to assume, just with the number of people who are infected, that infected citizens of Wisconsin will be going to other parts of the state and unknowingly infecting others in some instances, especially those who are asymptomatic and are still transmitting the virus.
Governor Evers met with Assembly Speaker Voss and Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald today to talk about potential new rules and the way forward. Do you think there's any hope that there could be agreement on some kind of new statewide order with a thumbs up from the legislature?
I don't know. I am always hopeful, but unfortunately, I'm not always optimistic, especially given the fact that they've had so long to come up with a plan. By them, I mean Republican leaders in the legislature. It took them weeks to even convene to come up with some sort of package to address the crisis. And anytime they've attacked Governor Evers' plan, anytime they said they didn't like it, what they didn't do is provide an alternative. And I've always, I always learned growing up that if I want to be critical about something, I should at least have a plan of my own. And we haven't seen that. We saw them run to the Supreme Court in an effort to do away with the Safer at Home order, and they were successful in doing so. We have yet to see a plan, and they've had so long to come up with one.
Assembly Speaker Voss had said this is about putting trust in Wisconsinites to do the right thing, business owners to take the right precautions. You and the administration put out guidelines for different business sectors around the state. Are you hopeful that people who are opening their businesses will take those guidelines into account and do it right?
I am hopeful, understanding that unfortunately there are some bad actors, but the majority of business owners, those are responsible. They don't want to see their customer base become infected. They don't want to see their customers lose their lives, because that means they're going to lose business. So any responsible business owner, it would be in their interest to follow the guidelines to make sure that they are, one, keeping themselves safe, but also keeping the people that walk into their doors safe as well.
Talking to Wisconsin Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, he's sharing his reactions to the state Supreme Court ruling yesterday that overturned the safer at home order around the state. Well, now that order is not in place. That phase out plan is no longer relevant, I guess. Lieutenant Governor Barnes, what is the focus of the administration now when it comes to COVID-19?
Yeah, the focus remains doing everything that we can do possibly to keep people safe. The focus is working with local governments, tribal governments, and offering them the resources and the guidelines that they're looking for to maintain public health and public safety. And we know that the wildfire-like spread of the virus isn't any different today than it was a week or two ago. We're also encouraging people to take those extra precautions, whether it's wearing a mask, whether it's social distancing, other PPE, and following all the safety guidelines that we've outlined.
We had this Badger bounce back plan in place, and We had hit, last I saw, I think, 5 of the 6 benchmarks that would have led to the next stage, to opening up. What could that have looked like if we'd stuck with that plan?
Yeah, if we stuck with that plan, it would have meant that we would have entered into a gradual reopening phase. That would have been phase one, where we could start to see things go back to normal, but in a gradual way, because you know that when we do these things, when you move with too much haste is where you compromise the most lives. You compromise the most people in their health. So that gradual process, unfortunately, where we looked at turning a dial, unfortunately, it could be more like a switch, which I hope not. Given the amount of lives that we stand to lose, given the amount of people that stand to contract the virus, I honestly, I hope that they're right. Just for the sake of the people living in Wisconsin, the people living all across this country, all across the world, I hope that they're right. But science says otherwise. The medical professionals say otherwise. And with that being the case, with doing this too fast, with reopening this rapidly, people are going to be put at risk.
One of the biggest critiques from Republicans and some others has been this is taking a huge economic toll, the shutdowns, even in areas that haven't really felt the impact of COVID-19, at least not yet. What would you say to people who have raised that concern about the economic damage here?
True enough, there is an economic input or economic impact, and there are areas that haven't experienced COVID-19 at the rate that others have. But that's because the safer at home order was working. That's because we were doing the right thing to make sure that that wasn't the case, to make sure that these communities with already burdened healthcare systems don't get overwhelmed. And the economic impact is not specifically in Wisconsin. I like to remind people of that. You know, what's going on here in our state isn't much different than any other state in the country. And that economic economic impact is being felt by far too many Americans. You look at the joblessness rate, you look at the unemployment rate across the country. This is not something unique to Wisconsin, and it's rather unfortunate when people want to play politics and point fingers at the governor of an individual state for a problem that is taking place nationally.
One open question mark now that wasn't affected, as I understand it, by the court ruling is schools in Wisconsin. The current plan is they're not opening their doors again this school year. What are the conversations now about getting schools ready to open maybe by September?
Yep, we have to figure it out. And I would say, too, one argument that I know I've been making for a while, and Governor Evers, especially as superintendent, had been making for a long time, is the need for us to have smaller classroom sizes. I hope that is a conversation that must take place. I hate that it got to this point where that's something that people will be taking seriously. But as a result, I do think there is a silver lining there to make sure that our students get the attention and resources that they deserve with smaller classroom sizes. But as far as the reopening, that's a conversation to be had with the superintendent of public instruction and school districts all across Wisconsin.
In our last minute and a half or so, we focused mostly on bouncing back in terms of health here in the state. How about the economy? What are you and the governor looking at to try to help us rebound as smoothly and quickly as possible when it comes to the economy?
I think this is going to require big, bold thinking. And again, this isn't an area where the state can act alone. We need full cooperation from the federal government. You look at the bounce back or what happened after the Great Depression with the New Deal. I think we find ourselves in this same sort of critical moment where we have to think bigger than we've ever thought before. We have to look at industries that have been struggling, and we have to look at emerging industries here in Wisconsin. We have to look at our challenges like climate change and see the opportunity that exists for us to meet the climate crisis, because that was here before COVID-19. It's going to be around after COVID-19 if we don't act. And we can couple those and come up with a strategy that will provide meaningful employment, gainful employment to folks, and also will do a great deal to preserve this planet for generations to come.
Lieutenant Governor Barnes, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Mandela Barnes, Wisconsin's lieutenant governor. He joined us today to talk about the state Supreme Court's ruling yesterday striking down the Safer at Home order and what comes next as the governor and Republicans in the legislature try to negotiate the way forward. You can find a lot more coverage of what has changed since yesterday over at WPR.org. The WPR news team is keeping a running tally of county and local governments that have put in their own equivalent to safer at home orders or other public health measures. You can also follow more interviews with policymakers here in Wisconsin from both parties here on the Ideas Network and at WPR.org/news. Teenage years can be tough and behaviors can change. Disobedience, lack of respect for authority, moodiness. I'm not talking about human teenagers here. I'm talking about dogs. According to research shared in a BBC article, animal behavior researchers say there can be a tough adolescence period for dogs at about 5 to 8 months old. Central Time producer Tim Peterson bears witness. Hey, Tim.
Hey there, Rob.
Have you been through a troubled teen period with a dog recently?
Yes, we recently adopted a dog. He is about 7 months old now. We think that he's a mix between a Rottweiler and Australian Shepherd. He's a rescue, and we definitely have been going through some of what was described in the article.
Yeah, what kind of things did you see?
Well, we've been working with some obedience things on him. He's not so great on the leash yet. He gets very distracted and reactive to other dogs when we're out on walks. But the thing we noticed this week in particular, and I should say we've been starting to work with a trainer, we went to get him a bath, and the folks at the dog salon said, "Oh, he's so well behaved. What a gem." And we're like, "Oh, really? Okay."
Oh, and sometimes we name names here on Central Time. Tim, what is this dog's name?
This dog's name is Finn, short, or Phineas.
All right. Well, good luck, Tim, with Finn. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.